apparently we have left this space and everything. All right. So I want to talk about file systems and, time permitting, I want to talk about recovery implications for persistence. We probably won't get to recovery until tomorrow. So what's a file system do? What are the responsibilities of a Unix style file system? What's it do?
Storage,
yes. What's
the interface between the user and the disk?
No, that's what a disk driver does. What does a file system do?
Find the logical view of
the data. A logical what?
A logical view of the data on disk.
Logical view
of the data.
This is all bullshit. Come on. File systems do something very specific. What are the operations on a file system?
Read and write.
Read and write. No, that's not an operation on a file system. Last time I checked, that would be an operation on a file. But is that operation implemented by a file system?
Okay.
Open and close. Alright, so what is it that happens when I do a read and write? Or most importantly, what is it that happens when I do a write?
You go through several interfaces, eventually you get to the file system driver that has that understand what to do with the device.
Okay, so in the end, right, what the file system does is organize the bytes. Right? It imposes organization on the bytes so they're retrievable, and hopefully it makes some kind of a consistency contract about those bytes. Okay, so the first thing a file system does is consistency and organization the byte sequences. And I'm going to ignore optimizations like special handling and zero pages and sparse files. We're already going to be complicated enough in two more steps. Okay. So actually, I want to break this part into two different parts. Okay. So the first part is simply organization of byte sequences. But the second part is making sure that consistency happens, which is really about I/O ordering and use of atomicity. Third thing
possible. Recover itself?
No, actually file systems don't recover themselves. There are other programs that do that. What they do, hopefully, as part of the consistency, is ensure as a matter of algorithmic choice that recovery may be possible. So there's an interaction with recovery. So let me, sort of list that as 2A, right? That it's the responsibility of the file system designer in some sense to plan for recovery by choosing appropriate algorithms. I'll buy it. Good. That's complex enough that it probably needs to be on my list and I wasn't going to have it, so thank you. What else does the file system do?
Metadata on those byte sequences.
What do you think of as metadata?
Unix file permissions, modified dates.
So there is a bunch of stuff that sits, kind of in the Unix inode structure, and yeah, there's a task there, but it's not really a very exciting issue. I'll leave that alone. There is a real, and there's definitely something file systems do. What else? What do you hand over?
Name.
What kind of name? How's that format?
Hierarchical.
Well, hierarchical, but it's a string, right? So far we've got organization of bytes and we've got consistency. What the hell does this have to do with strings? What else do file systems do?
Mapping file name to data.
More generally, though, mapping the name, right, by which we really mean a string in this context. This is not an OS-level name, this is a human-level name. So mapping strings to objects. These objects might either be files, or they might be directories. Now, those of you who have ever looked at a file system will have noticed that it's not like you get to do these things in isolation from each other. In fact, write to a file mostly can be done in isolation from directories. It's going to update the inode, but that's not going to change any information in the directory structure. Notice that when we add or remove entries from directories, that's intimately connected to the recovery algorithm. So in fact, we have a set of transactional constraints on our updates to the directory. Simply so that the directories remain intact so that we can traverse the file system so that we can recover. You can't just read and write directories. In very early versions of Unix, you could. And there were some celebrated disasters that came from that. If you went through the OS course here, you went through the consistency issues ad nauseum. Right? We talked about the file system hierarchy and how there's this file hierarchy of meta blocks and metameta blocks and blocks above those, the indirection blocks. Right, and if you really wanted to be robust about it, you actually had to write those from the bottom up. And you could never rewrite a block in place because you'd lose it. And we went through the WAPL design, the write ahead file, I don't remember what the A is. The upshot of it is it's an append only file system, right? The reason it's append only is so that it always can back up. Right? And this is hard. In fact, it's easier to do the append-only file design, except that you pay for it in write performance, usually. Right? We talked about the Eros checkpoint design in that course, and how it makes a trade that's a very curious trade, but a very effective trade, between temporal locality and spatial locality, which no other file system currently does, in quite the same way. Whether it's the right solution depends on your problem. In all of this, the big source of complexity is the consistency. If all I had to do was maintain an ordering on a byte sequence, even if that byte sequence was allocated out of blocks. Oh, and by the way, down at the bottom, right, there's all the block allocation stuff, and the block allocation, you know, has to be in on the joke about consistency, or the consistency manager has to be in on the joke about block allocation, right? So let's throw in storage allocation. All of this is hard because of consistency. And maybe because of recovery, but I think less so. Yeah?
Could you give a definition of consistency?
Okay, so consistency is if I pull the plug on a machine at any time, I have to be able to give you an algorithm that would allow you to scan the device and determine, for everything that's happened on the device, whether the state of that object is good, bad, or indeterminate. And in reality, we're going to resolve indeterminate by declaring bad. Okay, so if we have a file we have reason to believe is bad enough, we're going to delete it. If we have a directory entry for a file that doesn't appear to exist, we've got to reconcile that. So, in another way to look at it, in at least the classic Unix file system, is right, consistency is what FS check does when it comes up is it at least restores the file system to a state in which there are no dangling pointers, in fact. Right? That state may not be the one you want, but it's at least well defined. Okay. And so the consistency elements of the file system are basically about making sure that those dangling pointers either never happen, or they happen in a way where we can recognize the pattern under which they arose and we know what to do for purposes of recovery. So for example, here's an algorithmic constraint. When you do the CREAT call, you got to allocate the item before you create the directory. But otherwise, you can crash, and the inode might not be recorded to be allocated, somebody else will allocate it, and now you get a broken directory. In fact, not only do you have to allocate the inode, but you have to allocate the inode in a recoverably survivable way. Right? So it's actually got to go to disk if you really want to be careful about this, before the directory entry. Now, strictly speaking, it turns out it doesn't really matter, because if the directory entry goes first, that's one that FSCheck can detect and say, oh, I've got a directory entry for an unallocated inode. That's not good. Conversely, I have an inode that is not referenced, an allocated inode that is not referenced by the directory. That's not good. Okay. So there is a set of places where I can take shortcuts and I can do things simultaneously because I know something about the recovery algorithm and I know something about its decision procedure. But barring that, I actually have to be careful about the order of operations. There's also an issue, if I lose, how much do I lose? So in the WAML file system, if a write to a file is in progress when the file system fails, I've always got a previous version of the file I can back out to. Okay. In the classic Unix file system, if that write occurs in the file metadata, in the indirection blocks, right, I can get a dangling pointer in an indirection block. Okay. And the fix in Unix is either to truncate the file or to delete it. Right. Loss of a single file is considered an acceptable loss as far as the recovery strategy is concerned. If that file is a password, you might not agree. That probably was more of an answer than you really want. All right. So look, it's not hard to organize byte sequences. Right? We know how to build trees. Oh, if you don't know how to build trees, you're in the wrong classroom. And we probably even know, you know, how to deal with the fact that the unit of storage at the disk level is going to be a sector, so we're going to have a partially filled sector, right? So we'll have one block at the end of the tree that's not full. So what? This is not algorithmically challenging. In fact, even if we had to do it concurrently, look, either you and I are manipulating the same file or we're not. It's not that hard even to grab a lock at the top of the tree before we update it, so the concurrent threads won't be updating the same thing at the same time, right? That would not be such a big deal. Again, ignoring concurrency, it's not that hard to update the directory data structure. There's a little bit of care that we have in the directory because we really like large directories to scale them. So one of the changes that finally made into Linux a couple of years ago was hash-structured directories. The idea is if I know I'm looking for a certain name and all I'm trying to do is a lookup, there's a hash algorithm that I can use that will tell me with high likelihood which block of the directory the entry corresponding to that name is in. And why do I care? Because I don't want to do a large number of seeks for directories. And if I guess wrong, the old directory style, I actually had to read the directory linearly. The directory holds 100 items. It's not so bad. The directory holds 100,000 items. It's a bit of a pain in the ass. And let me tell you, when we did OpenCM, we had directories that held hundreds of thousands of items, and the results were not pretty. The entire overhead was due to the directory. It was really impressive to do that. That algorithm is not intrinsically complicated. And we could change it. For example, to go from linear search to the hash structured search. Right? And that hash structured algorithm is not in and of itself tricky. mean, yeah, you have to learn a little bit about hash, right? But in principle, this is not a big complicated thing. What makes it really complicated is that when I update the directory, not only do I have to get the hash algorithm right, but I have to do it in such a way that when I go to write the update back to the disk, if somebody trips over the plug, my file system doesn't go south. And the basic tool that we would normally use for this would be transactions. You may have noticed that that's not an abstraction inside Unix kernel. There's no such BC. BC is a technical term. It comes from Scotland.
Not really.
Okay, there's no such BC, right? So a lot of what a file system does is implement an ad hoc transaction system, usually badly. You may have noticed RiserFS, right, had all of these bugs for the longest time. It took four major versions for RiserFS to become stable enough that you should get your data on it. And it's not because Hans is an idiot. Hans is not an idiot. He's a very smart guy. He's done some very interesting algorithms work in RiserFS. It's because the interaction between those algorithms and the requirements of transactional stability were horribly complicated. My concern about RiserFS is not whether Hans can get it right. It's whether if Hans is hit by a bus, anybody else can ever get it right. Okay? This is called a single point of failure. In the human domain, it's very expensive. Just for the record, I have not hired a bus to... Okay. So, you know, the underlying tool here is atomicity, right? We build transactions essentially out of exploiting the atomicity of disk writes. That's not strictly true. Right? We actually induce atomicity on the disk writes because, in fact, disks can fail in ways that leave sectors partially written. What we rely on is that that condition is detected with very, very, very high likelihood. Right? Disks, all disks now, didn't used to be so, all disks now implement something called a cyclic redundancy check. Basically, if the data that goes out is garbage, you can rely pretty well on the fact that when it comes back, it's not going to smell right. And you'll get told by the disk, I was unable to reread that sector. And there are basically two reasons that can happen. One is the write fail, and the other is the metal oxide fail. The one we're concerned about here is the write fail. Well, as long as you're writing to alternating blocks for your transaction header, that's okay. You always have some place to go back to. Okay. There's another issue. Right? Not only are we implementing an ad hoc transaction system in a file system, but in a certain sense, we're implementing it at a very, very small granularity. Every update to a directory, if I really want a hardened file system, I can't let the program proceed until that update has gone all the way to the disk. Because I can't rely on the directory update having happened. This is why you see options in the SCFS tab that say, no, don't sync the directories. I'm willing to accept the fact that the entire file system may be toast, because by accepting that fact, I'll gain a factor of 5 to 10 in file system performance. Simply by being able to batch the updates. Right? You see options on NFS that say, don't do synchronous I.O. I'm not willing to wait for the network round trips. I'll break the semantics of the file system in order to get better performance. So we have a compounding of two situations. Right? One is we have a very primitive, difficult to use set of ad hocly exploited tools. Ad hocly, good. Invent a word. Of tools that are being exploited in ad hoc fashion, mainly atomicity and transactions. Right? And then we're going to put a lot of pressure on those tools by using them with really high intensity. Okay? And it won't surprise you that historically file systems have been a source of a large number of system failures, either because the code actually notices that something went bad and calls panic, or the code, worse, doesn't notice that something went bad and fails to call panic. Which one's better, by the way? Okay, so here's a clue. Once something is known bad, the solution is not to just continue computing and ignore it. Okay? Because the more you do that, right, the more further change you're going to make to the system state, and the further you migrate down a bad path, the less and less likely it is that you're going to recover successfully. The motto here should be fail early and often and aggressively. Okay? Fail as fast as you can. And then try to get those failures out of the system. The one thing you don't want to do is cause failures to go unnoticed, because then you've got corruption and you don't get repair. Right? And these are both bad outcomes. Granted, I'm telling a bit of a selective story here about file systems, but does anybody sort of dispute the core of this story, that there's a bunch of algorithm stuff going on and a bunch of transactional stuff going on, and the interaction between these things is complicated? There's a reason RiserFS is really large, or EXT3. I mean, it's not, and I don't need to pick on Riser. These are big systems. All right. Suppose I told you that we could get the transaction story out of the files, eliminate it entirely. Well, you tell me that I was full of something, and you'd be right. But what we can do is move it to a different place. Why is it important that the file system is doing these very fine-grained transactions? Right? It's important because there's no larger scale definition of consistency in the system. Once I return from the write call, the application performing the write is going to go on and do other activity. Other applications are going to depend on that activity. Right? And that's the case of, you know, that's the opportunity for progressive cascading failure codes. Right? It's the fact that once I say the write went to disk, I am committed to not having lie. Well, suppose, instead of trying to do that, we had a system where we actually knew that that forward computation effectively could be canceled. And either everything's going to happen in a consistent way, or if it turns out we got it wrong, we're just going to back out. Well, then I don't need to do transactions in the file system at all, because I can rely on the underlying system to guarantee that. So what do I need to actually do? I still need to guarantee consistency in the sense that I need to guarantee that two distinct updates in my file system don't interfere with each other, right? I still have all the exposures that go with concurrency. And those exposures have nothing to do with transactions. Right? I should have added concurrency to this. I mean, I'm trying to do all this transaction stuff, and I'm trying to run these algorithms, and I'm trying to do it 5 times at once in the same data structure, or 100 times at once in the same data structure. Okay, so here's a weird observation. We all know that concurrency is hard, I hope. Concurrency is something that you should look at as a strategy of absolute last resort. Because the minute you introduce shared memory concurrency into your program, your hope of debugging it ever just ended. There's one known exception to that pattern, right? It's just about possible to have some kind of a work dispatch queue where I queue up a bit of work and I have a bunch of worker threads that operate independent of each other. Right? We know how to do data flow. What we don't know how to do is general shared memory concurrency. Not robustly. Okay? So here's the observation. Why do people do multi-threading? Because they don't want to wait. You don't start another thread if the thing you're trying to ask for service is always available. What would the second thread do? Right? You start a second thread because the first thread's taking too long. Now, here's a trivia quiz question. I have a system that's taking too long. Is the right thing to do to fix the design, or is the right thing to do to make it unmaintainable? I mean, not that I want to put a value judgment on this. Of course I want to put a value judgment on this. Unmaintainability is usually not the right answer. Okay. The problem is that re-architecting things is, you know, from a management, from a how to manage your manager kind of a standpoint, right? Going to them and saying, by the way, we need to chuck the file system because the architecture sucks and we need to build a new one. This is not a career-extending strategy, so people resist it. They say, no, no, we'll add concurrency, it'll be okay, it'll take us some time, we can do it incrementally, we don't have to throw out this investment to this code that if it had been any good, we wouldn't have had this problem in the first place, but it's okay. Like, people are very tied to the idea that writing new code is somehow more expensive and less reliable. The data says that's not true. Try getting your manager to believe it. The data says there's a threshold where the right thing to do is throw the code away to increase reliability. There's no magic to it. The code accretes changes over time, right? Those changes don't have the sort of degree of adherence to the original architecture that the original code did, right? The code grows warts over time. And eventually those warts overcome the problem. We've all seen it. So the solution is to get rid of the latency. Okay, well, if you have these transactions that happen at disk speeds, guess what your chances are of pulling that off? If you think slightly less than zero, you're on the right track.
So why don't you just improve memory?
Why don't you just improve memory? So how would you improve memory?
Well, I guess the Barton Hall and Buffy.
Go to Barton Hall. So I mean, there's actually are serious efforts to do that. One of the reasons that there's a large appeal to solid-state storage, right, is that it doesn't have disk latency. Disk latency, it's physics latency. It's not electronic latency, right? It comes from taking this very heavy arm, right? Heavy, you know, like micrograms, right? This really light arm, right? But this arm that's actually got to move pretty fast and shoving it around. There are people building MEMS devices that have different designs for that. I'm not hugely fond of the MEMS devices, but there are other people who are just saying, look, to hell with that, we'll just use static RAM. And the price of static RAM is coming down very quickly, right? You can go out and you can buy an iPod today with a 4 gigabyte flash device in it for $200. Maybe it's less on the street. Now, you know what the price curves look like for disk drives, right? And they're exactly the same for DRAMs. And if you look at American manufacturing capacity, at least here, you'll see almost all the manufacturing capacity shifted to static storage. Right? And that's now happening in Taiwan. And in Korea. Right? All the money's going there. If you listen to the rhetoric from the disk drive manufacturers or the drive manufacturers, this is always a tip-off, right? The tip-off that an industry is dying is when the executives start saying things like, no, it's okay, they can't hit us in the high end. Right? So the disk drive manufacturers, and you can read in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, I think it was Seagate, but don't hold me to that, one of their executives said, yes, these solid-state storage devices are very attractive if you only have to hold a couple of gigabytes. But they're not going to scale. I seem to remember that the 8-inch floppy drive manufacturers made the same statement about the 5.25-inch floppy drive manufacturers, who made the same statement about the 2.5-inch floppy drive manufacturers. The 14-inch hard drive manufacturers with the multi-platters that were removable platters that were gone before most of you guys were born, they made the same things about HDA assemblies. The 8-inch hard drive people certainly said it about the 5.25-inch hard drive people. The 5.25 guys said it about the 3.5s. The 3.5s looked at the 2.5s and said, those things are tiny, they'll never be a threat. How many 5.25-inch drives do you find in your local store today. So when the drive manufacturers say about the static store guys, those guys will never be a threat. They're stuck on the low end. What do you think? I think it's time to sell my stock in CNAME, frankly. Right? In this term, by the way, this is the story of the drive industry. The story of the drive industry is somebody comes in with a new lower-end technology that initially applies in a domain that the larger drive can't reach, mainly because of form factor. Right? 2.5-inch drives came in because of laptops. 1-inch drives came in because of cameras. And the new device goes into a form factor the old device can't hit. And in that new form factor, it's the only game in town, and it doesn't matter that it's low capacity. And then the technology improves. Right? And those delightful people in Asia who are really, really good at iterating the technology absolutely to death do their thing, and 4 years later, you wake up and discover you can now buy a 1-inch micro drive that stores 40 gigabytes. Which, by the way, you can do that. I remember holding one of the very first of those micro drives in my hand when it was 1 gigabyte, and that was considered a big deal. And that was only 3 years ago. Excuse me, it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's not
what?
That's not an idea in Santa Cruz. It's part of the incentive for that was just to see if you can do it.
Just to see if you can do it. Yeah. Right. So I mean, let me calibrate that drive visually for you if I have one. Right? The platter on that drive is this size, the size of a quarter. Right? I held one of Ted Selker's first drives in my hand. I was in the research group at IBM that was looking to figure out what the hell we would do with them. Right? And the answer in the end probably was nothing. Okay? And the reason it was nothing was not because of any flaw in the technology. In fact, they are being used, right? But it's because the solid-state stuff came along fast enough, right, that the micro drive couldn't stay ahead. Okay. So your suggestion that we should fix the memory is not a bad suggestion. Suppose we fix the memory. Let's play with that for a minute. Suppose we fix the memory. Does that solve the complexity problem? Does that make this code more maintainable? Are most of the failures in a file system failures on the disk, or are they failures in the software? Give you a hint, they're not failures in the disk. Remember my comment, right? All software programmers believe that they're in the top 2%.
Right? Get a death star and say it's a failure.
Right, yeah, so if we set aside IBM's Hitachi drives, it's probably not a failure of the disk. Right, yeah, there was a generation, and I had several of those in laptops, actually. So look, it's not just about latency, it's also about complexity. Right? And the one place where you really would like to keep complexity out of the system is the place where the stuff that's important to you is getting written down. Because that's the place where you're likely to lose it if you screw up. All right. So here's the punchline. The server that implements the equivalent, actually there are two, that implements the equivalent of file system behavior in Eros is 200 lines. Okay? And it's only that big because it does some very, very aggressive tricks to do zero copy I/O. So we have two objects that together implement the function of a file system. The first is the one that we call the file server. Okay? And you can instantiate more than one of these. In fact, we often do. The file server implements the file part of a file system. Okay? So it creates files, okay? It does read and write, and it does destroy. Approximately, think of this as everything from the inode layer down. And it's 200 lines because it actually takes 100 lines of C code to build a decent tree data structure. And the other 100 lines is actually some disgustingly clever stuff so that when the incoming IPC comes in that delivers the string, it's the block that we're trying to write, then it always goes to a not yet allocated block, but the, having come in, it never has to be copied again. So, really, what I mean by a file server is, right, it implements the file object. In fact, it can implement multiple file objects. In Kikos, there was one server per file. We thought that was a little bit too high on the overhead scale. And separate from this, there's a directory object. This thing implements a mapping from strings to capabilities. The current one is actually a little bigger than the file object because we implemented it by stealing the Berkeley directory code. We just chopped out all the rest of the file system credit. But this is also a very straightforward, linearly structured program. One process, one directory. And that's something we're also looking at changing. Mainly because paths are hierarchical and the traversal walk is a little more expensive than I'd like it to be. Okay. Each of these objects is single-threaded. And there's your concurrency problem. Go.
Is it single-threaded even in a multi-process?
Yes. But let me finish the story about single-threading. Okay. Single-threading means that every file that is created by this particular file server, right, the file server only has one thread. But remember, this file server never does explicit disk IO. Its most expensive operation is memcopy. And that's to shuffle blocks around for placement purposes. Effectively, the most expensive operation you do when you talk to a file in this system is the cross-address-based data copy for the block, which you could not have avoided in this system. Each directory is single-threaded, but distinct directories have distinct threads. So, if you and I are simultaneously trying to do a lookup in the top directory of the file system, one of us is going to wait for the other. Here again, remember this is an in-memory operation. But if in our second stage, right, so I look at /A/B, and you look at /C/D, if my lookup of A and your lookup of C are going to compete, but at the second level, we're now talking about different applications. And what are we going to block for? Well, I say this is an in-memory object, and at the top of a given file system, that's highly likely to be true, but in principle, it might have to do a paging operation to fetch whatever it needs. With high likelihood, it was going to have to do that paging in a conventional file system as well. Having the second thread isn't going to help. That one's just going to block as well. Now, I'm not saying there's no motivation for a multi-threaded directory structure. I think, in fact, there is a motivation for a multi-threaded directory structure. I'm saying you can start with something simple and commit to something complicated when you've got an utterly compelling reason to do it. And we haven't found one here. Now, why does this work out? What happened to the concurrency? And what happened to the consistency? Well, what happened to the consistency is my interaction with the file system object happened inside a larger consistency boundary, which was the one established by the checkpoint logic. So, if my write succeeds, meaning it's gone to memory in the file object, and I proceed to compute forward, then either both the file object and I will later checkpoint together, or neither of us will. So what matters is not the issue of agreement about, what matters is that we're in agreement about what are the consequences of failure in a certain way. That we fail in terms that are consistent with respect to each other, or we succeed in terms that are consistent with respect to each other. Right? What would be bad is if we were to fail and not be in agreement about what had happened. One last observation. Why do I point to this single-threaded thing and whine about concurrency? Because the server is single-threaded, there is an implicit critical region that wraps every operation done by that server. If I call the server and it accepts a request and runs to completion before it accepts the next request, well then the next request can't come in the middle of this one. The entire request with respect to this server operates as a single unit of operation. That's called a transaction. Well, not quite. It's not a transaction because we don't have a stabilization story here. But what we do have, right, is we have the consistency part of the ACID properties. And that, combined with this exogenous transaction mechanism provided by persistence, plus the fact that we're not just we're not just persisting data, we're persisting control flow. So suppose this file gets halfway through, or it gets in a block, now it's got to insert it into the correct tree of the correct file. Suppose it gets halfway through the insert, right? And our checkpoint mechanism hits us there, right? And we actually stabilize successfully. Now, in the state that we just wrote on the disk, we're halfway through a tree update. But when we come back, and now we fail. After we capture this state, we fail. So when we come back, we're halfway through a tree update. And it's not just that we're halfway through a tree update and the data structure is now hanging in space. We're halfway through a tree update and the program counter points to the instruction whose job it is to do the next step in the tree update. And that's true collectively across all the pieces of the system that might be collaborating. That contract stops at the machine boundary. And we could extend it to a cluster, but it turns out you don't want to extend this to a national scale. So it's still the case that when two machines fail, they fail independently and you got to do something about it. Just as you do in the Unix system. But what you get is, in the local case, right, a lot of the critical code in critical places gets to go away, and this preservation of control flow coupled with single-threaded operation or with appropriately locked multi-threaded operation, right, gives you a guarantee that sequencing of operations can be preserved even if for some reason it's interrupted in the middle by a failure. So let me take questions about any of this. I'm seeing these stunned looks, right? These are the kind of looks that the cow has shortly before it drops dead in the field. I watched Constantine last night. It's a really weird movie. What do people think about this? Is this crazy? I mean, obviously it's crazy. Does it smell plausible? I mean, you can't know until you actually work with it, but does it smell like this might be plausible? Maybe. There is something weird about this. Okay. In every other system, you build processes out of files. Right? And I've said to you a couple of times that in this system you build files out of processes. And that's kind of upside down. Well, this is how you do it. And you rely on the fact that the processes logically run forever. Now, to foreshadow tomorrow, the problem with processes that run forever is cosmic rays. That's not a joke. Right? We actually measure annually several memory hits that corrupt the state of the system. Right? And now the question is going to be, what do you do about it? What do you do about in-memory failures? Right? Especially since these cheap twits at Dell and elsewhere are unwilling to ship ECC memory because it's expensive. So what do you do about in-memory failures? And how do you recover from on-disk failures? And I don't have silver bullets to offer for either of these questions. We've got a pretty good answer to the first one. There's no silver bullets on the disk failure issue, but there's also no silver bullets in the Unix issue. So what I'm going to try to convince you tomorrow is the exposure to disk failure is actually no greater in this system than in any other in practice. Okay. See you guys tomorrow. Oh, also, I have all but one of the midterms graded. There was one that I did indeed misplace, and I now got that one. It's going to get graded probably in the next 15 minutes. But based on the numbers I am seeing so far, there's absolutely no difference numerically between any of you, which is exactly the outcome that I was expecting. Excuse me, no statistically significant difference, which is exactly the outcome I was suspecting. There seems to be one universally shared confusion that I will clarify tomorrow, but I'm actually really, really happy with the midterm results. They were all pretty good.